Disruption Zone. Opportunity lives where the status quo dies. Talking to the greatest innovators, disruptors, and off-the-wall inventors we can scrounge up. You laugh, you'll learn, you'll be inspired. Now, here are your hosts, Leland Conway and Cameron Mills.
It is the Disruption Zone. I am Leland Conway. I'm happy to welcome back one of my favorite guests. I love the Pegasus Institute and the work that they do. They are independent thinkers, and they're trying to come up with policies that help better Kentucky and better us as a nation. And you can find them at pegasuskentucky.org. And my friend Josh Crawford is on the line with us this morning. Hey, Josh, how are you?
I'm doing quite well, Leland. How about yourself?
I'm good. Boy, there's a lot to take in recently, and we're going to talk about two topics today. First of all, the absolutely ridiculous idea of defunding the police and how that will actually exacerbate the problems that some communities are having around the country, and also what in the heck is going on with the Supreme Court. So we're going to kind of have a broad discussion here. But let's start with the idea of defunding the police. First of all, I want to make it clear that it should be understood that one of the arguments that people that are saying defund the police are coming back with, when you say that's a ludicrous idea, what will we do without police? They go, well, we don't really mean to disband the police. Or in some cases, they'll talk about some, I don't know, unicorn-staffed public safety division or something that's overseen by civilians, which is ironic because police are civilians. There's no military state aspect of it. The police are actually civilians. It's part of our civilian government. And so the idea that we would replace the police force with a civilian-run police force is really not any different than what we have now. So that's silly. But they will come back and say that's not exactly what they're trying to do. But there's a huge range here of what they're trying to do. On some cases, they're literally just trying to dismantle fully corrupt police departments and start over, which in some cases may actually be the right thing to do. Whereas in other cases, they're wanting full anarchy, like the extreme case in Seattle with the whole Chaz organization. So hopefully I've laid the groundwork there for you, Josh. But it certainly seems to be a cry of the left today, defund the police, and a lot of politicians are getting in on it.
Yeah, that's the problem with any slogan like that it means different things to different people. But I would point your listeners to a New York Times op-ed from last week that said, yes, we mean abolish the police. And what that op-ed goes on to say is that their vision, and you've seen this with the council president of the city council up in Minneapolis, she talks about a police-free society. And so while it may mean different things to different people, the crux of that belief of defund the police or abolish the police is quite literally to abolish the police. And I've obviously given this some thought. We've got the op-ed out on this issue, but I genuinely don't know if there would be a more inequitable policy in America than disbanding public police departments. Because the reality, right, is that here in Louisville, our affluent neighborhoods tomorrow, if they abolish the police today, would have Blackwater police departments. They'd have, you know, private right. militia police departments to protect their neighborhoods, and they would remain safe the way they are now. It would be our most vulnerable and at-risk communities who would bear the brunt of the negative consequences of a policy decision.
Yeah, it would be
that.
In those areas, it would be the purge, or it would be what we're seeing in Chaz, where you have a warlord who's self-appointed, who's going around
right.
beating people. Based on what, you know, doling out punishment that he sees fit, and they're armed, by the way. You know, so it's ludicrous. And I pulled up the New York Times article. It was written by Miriam Kaba. I don't know who she is. It just says that Miss Kaba is an organizer against criminalization, which is a very broad title. You know, I don't want to get into who she is or what she's saying here, other than, you know, that it says, yes, we literally mean abolish the police. Why has this taken hold? Because it doesn't take a lot of logic to come to the conclusion that if you literally mean to abolish the police as opposed to deep reform, maybe, which is, you know, here's the way I look at it. I was listening to a podcast the other day, and Jocko Willink was making a really interesting point. And he said, you know, there are some places like Minneapolis, for instance, there was a lot of corruption in that police department. And I think a symptom of that corruption is when you have a guy standing on a guy's neck for 8 minutes and 45 seconds and his fellow cops don't say a damn thing while everybody is going, dude, right? That's a symbol that right. there's some major corruption going on in that police department. I think we need to listen when we are brought these concerns by our fellow citizens. You know, I can't breathe is what their slogan is, and I think we need to listen to that. And when they say we need to abolish the police, probably it'd be a great idea for President Trump to go to Minneapolis and say, let's sit down and talk about this. Let's talk about what would happen if we abolish the police. But let's also talk about why you're saying this and what exactly has happened in order to give you that point of view, right? You don't listen at all when somebody says, no, I want them all gone. Like, there's no conversation to be had there.
Right. The reality is that this has just become sort of the loudest rallying cry as a part of this. Public support for abolish the police is in the low double digits. It's in the teens.
Right.
This is not something that average Americans of any race, color, or creed believe in. But it has been amplified by a very small group of very loud activists who are promoting it as a narrative. And so one of the things that I have a major issue with the sort of defund the police mantra is it does, in my opinion, detract from serious and real reforms that we can and should be talking about.
Right.
I think Senator Scott put forward a bill this week that is a giant step in the right direction from the feds. But the reality is that policing is a very local practice. And so, you know, we have these laboratories of democracy in our states and cities where we can play around and do some reforms. And in my opinion, the cities have already done this for decades, and we can learn from the cities that moved away from suppression style policing strategies and towards intelligence led policing strategies. And we can and should do those things. But the unseriousness of defund the police only hurts that conversation.
Vox had a piece the other day, and they said, well, abolish the police moves the Overton window. And for those that aren't familiar with the Overton window, it's this idea that, and the right and left both do it, right? But it's this idea of saying something so extreme that people are happy to come back to something that's a little less extreme. And I think that, you know, when I saw that article, I thought this is the problem that we have in America, right? That the only way to have a conversation and move the ball on anything that needs to be done, apparently, is to move the Overton window by shouting so loud and saying something so, astronomically stupid that the world just kind of takes a sigh of relief when it's just not quite as bad as all that, right? Right? Like right. When the left says, we want Chaz all over America, and we all go, ah, that's a terrible idea. Okay, we'll take the unicorn social police or whatever it is you guys said. That's way better. I mean, like that right. to me is a terrible way to have a discussion about doing meaningful things that need to be done. It's not leadership.
The other thing about it, too, is it could backfire, right? Because I'm sympathetic to the expanding the Overton window. It's something that we talk about in think tanks all the time. Mm-hmm. But the reality is if you try to anchor the conversation too far, you risk your negotiating partner getting up from the table and walking away.
Right.
You know, if Tony Romo is going to be the highest paid, sportscaster on network TV, he can move that window out a little bit and demand something unprecedented. But if he sits down and says, I want $100 million, CBS, NBC, whomever is just going to get up and walk away.
Right.
The same is true in public policy. You can try to expand that Overton window, but if you sit down and try to anchor the conversation too far in one direction or the other, you risk alienating the majority of the people you're negotiating with.
Right.
And I think that's what you're going to see with defund the police. When you've got 16% approval, among Americans, when 60% of African Americans want more police and more resources for law enforcement in their neighborhood, not less, when it's 65% among Caucasian Americans, you're not in a great bargaining place to begin
with. Well, when you get a situation where you have a large number of people shouting defund the police, and then you get a prosecutor in Atlanta and, you know, basically charging a police officer who, at least according to Georgia law, and I'm not going to make any comments about that particular situation because I haven't seen the video, And what I do know is I refrain from talking about specific incidents now because we always find more video and there's always another angle and there's always more information, right? But you see what's happening in Atlanta where they have this big case of the blue flu, where literally thousands of police officers have just walked off the job, at least temporarily, because they're saying, look, if we're going to abide by Georgia law and still get charged with murder, potentially being put in jail for life or get the death penalty for doing what we consider to be our jobs by Georgia law. So you run the risk of things like that, where when you are saying something so, you know, like absurd as abolish the police, police over here are going, well, if you don't want us, you're going to find out what it's like. And wasn't it, was it Boston that in 1920 had a walkout and like 4 days later, nine people were dead and like absolute melee ensued?
Yep. In 1919, the Boston police officers wanted to basically form a union, and they had had significant trouble doing so. And so they basically took an informal vote and said, what if we went on strike? And so in September of 1919, the Boston Police Department, 80% of the officers walked off the job.
Wow.
And over the course of 4 days, nine people were killed. I mean, in today's dollars, tens of millions of dollars in destruction to the city. And so we do have a bit of a glimpse of what a police-free world looks like, and it's not a particularly pretty picture.
I think here's how I see, and I want to get your thoughts on this. I see us moving forward like this, because I agree with the fact that at a point where you have a police officer put his knee on the neck of an individual for 8 minutes who is crying out to his dead mother, that there's a problem there with that officer. And there is a problem with the officers who stand around. And I think that's indicative of a problem with the culture in that police department. Okay. So reform, I think, is a legitimate discussion to be had. I think what we need to do right now, we're talking about defunding the police or cutting their budget. Everybody's turning their back on the 99% of police officers who get up every morning and just want to protect their community. What I think needs to be done is the opposite of how we're approaching it. Instead of making the police in general, by and large, sort of the scapegoat in the whole idea of reform, we need to be talking about how do we bring in better police officers? Because right now we're going to get a self-fulfilling prophecy, right? Only the most authoritarian people who just literally get their complete rocks off on having authority and dominion over people are going to join now, because that thrill is going to be all that's left of being a police officer, right? The risk is going to be too high for people of high integrity. People of high integrity who just want to raise their families and protect their community are going to say, it's not worth going to jail for doing my job. People who enjoy lording over others will take that risk. We're going to have a self-fulfilling philosophy of authoritarian police officers who follow the letter of the law instead of having expanded relational points of view, right? So if we're saying we're not going to have a relationship with you, they're not going to have a relationship with us. So you're going to get this very cold, very sort of European, stern, follow the letter of the law, don't care what you say, authoritarian, established police, if we go this direction, right, that everybody's talking about right now. Whereas on the other hand, if we say, let's pay them better, let's give them better benefits, and let's make it as hard as being a Navy SEAL to become one, then you get the best of the best, right? Instead of just sending them 3 months and setting them off on their own to learn how to police, let's have them do at least one or two police training days every other week. There should be extra training. There should be multiple training. There should be training and additional training and de-escalation. It should be a constant thing that these guys are training all the time, and it should be hard to become a police, and they should get paid better and have better benefits. Is that wrong?
No, I think a lot of that is right. I know the Navy SEAL thing has come up quite a bit lately as a comparison, and it's not a perfect comparison given the way that Navy SEALs train for specific missions and the basically the amount of tax dollars that are invested in a Navy SEAL, and to equate that to local police departments would cost sort of exorbitant amounts of money.
No, but you can weed out people who have bad intentions. It doesn't have to be physical training so much as psychological training, ethical training, etc.
Right, but I think you're right to say that we should move in that direction.
Right.
Of training all the time, of higher pay, of better work, and the reality is that literally all of that costs money. That means additional dollars for policing, not fewer dollars for policing.
Right.
You know, one of the things that I think officers need additional training in is things like defensive tactics and hand-to-hand combat.
Right.
If officers are more willing to engage with non-lethal force, then we reduce the risk posed by reaching for the belt, pulling a gun, and the use of lethal force.
But that does that does require better physical training, though, because there are some police departments where you see a guy and you're like, dude, how did you pass the physical requirements? You know what I'm saying? I'm like, you ain't hopping a fence chasing a perp. You know what I mean?
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And so, you know, we need changes in police tactics. We need additional and better training. We need to recruit and retain better officers.
Right.
And all of that is important. All of that will help police community relations, but all of that requires more money, not less.
Don't you think that, because here's one of the other problems that I think we'll have if we continue down this road. Like, I think that we're almost talking about the exact opposite, but I do think we're chasing the wrong target here. Like, I would say to my friends who want to see reform, because one of the big discussion points is we have a disparity, a racial disparity in our jail system. And like, that is true, and we need to fix that. And I think the best way to fix that is to look at how easy it is to become a criminal in America today. So I think a lot of the money that we're talking about shifting into communities of need could be found not by taking it from the police, but I think there's enough money in the criminalization of things that probably ought not be criminalized to be able to give the police even more to find better officers, better train, better pay, and give some to these communities to try to help empower people, et cetera. In other words, I think we should be looking at the broader justice system beyond just the police department. I think the police department is an easy target when maybe it might not be the right target.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the conversation needs to quite frankly, be bigger than it is right now. So often we focus on the officer on the street and their individual actions, which at times may reflect the individual predispositions of that officer. It may be the sort of quintessential bad egg. But to your point about Minneapolis and some of the other ones, there's a line in Remember the Titans where Julius Campbell says to Jerry Bertier, "Attitude reflects leadership, Captain."
Right.
And I think that in some of these police departments, you see that attitude reflects leadership. And if your chief and your command staff and your lieutenants are not creating a culture in which good policing is rewarded and bad behavior is not tolerated, then you will see that culture permeate the department.
Yeah, there's
and
a...
So,
go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to interrupt. Go ahead.
Oh, no, that's fine. And just so I do think the conversation needs to be larger than just how do we change the individual officer on the street? And so whether that is more encompassing of the whole criminal justice system or of departments as a whole.
There is a documentary on Netflix called The 7-5. It's about a NYPD officer, Michael Dowd, kind of talking about the corruption of the New York Police Department in the 70s, 80s, early 90s. To your point, there are places in America where there still tends to be a circle the wagon aspect to policing. When one guy does something bad, it's not that the other cops are bad or corrupt. It's that there's maybe a fear of that stain as opposed to a very strong sense of we need to eject that person. There's a sense in some departments to hide that. You know what I mean? To hide that corruption. That's what you're talking about. That needs to be inverted. It needs to be what you're saying is it needs to be rewarded to literally out and whistleblow and get rid and weed out the bad guys, as opposed to there being some sort of peer pressure not to say something when somebody does something wrong and unethical.
Right. We have to be able to differentiate between what is wrong and unethical and immoral, and what are good faith mistakes.
Right. Yeah.
And so we ought to circle the wagons around law enforcement officers when there are good faith mistakes made, because we entrust them with an incredible amount of responsibility.
Right.
And we expect for them to perform in situations that most people run from, not towards.
Yeah.
And so we ought to grant officers wide latitude when making good faith mistakes, but we ought to also condemn in the strongest terms and with the strongest actions behaviors that are unethical or immoral. This is one of the things about Bill Bratton's tenure as New York City Police Commissioner. What Bill Bratton is most remembered for is the crime decline in the late 1990s for Comstat, for the reforms he put in place that reduced homicides and shootings by tremendous amounts. But a big part of what he also did was to root out the corruption within the department, to root out those individuals who were benefiting from their position, who were lying on the stand, all that kind of stuff. And so those two things are not only not in conflict with one another, but in the sort of greatest example of turnaround of a police department in American history, in the New York Police Department of the 1990s, both happened simultaneously.
We need more of that. Like, you know,
absolutely.
We need more leaders like that.
Absolutely.
You mentioned in your piece, which is on KentuckyToday.com and also on the Pegasus website, that the desire, this is what you said, the desire for a police-free society reflects a misunderstanding of both the societal benefit of policing and the actual desires of the communities. That, I think, is another misconception here. I was driving back to my neighborhood the other day, and there's a cop sitting at the top of the hill close to the entrance to the neighborhood. You can look at that one of two ways. Why is he watching me? Or thank God he's watching. You know what I mean?
Right.
And so the benefits are that, you know, probably nobody's going to do anything, you know, shaky in my neighborhood if there's a cop sitting at the top of the hill close to the entrance to the neighborhood.
Right.
You know, that is what you might want to call proactive policing. He's not doing anything. He's just sitting there, probably eating his lunch. You know, he was pulled off on the side of the road. There was no demeanor or anything. He was just sitting there in his car, probably eating his lunch. But there was a deterrent factor to someone who is up to no good, and to someone who's not up to no good, there was a relief factor. And you go through the statistics that even in those areas, African Americans want more policing in those areas because they want to be safe. We have parents in the West End of Louisville that do not want their kids to have to sleep in a bathtub to avoid stray bullets. That requires more proactive policing, but responsible proactive policing. And it's hard to have that conversation.
Absolutely. And this is one of the things of nuance and to what we've been talking about already, that these conversations are often bigger than the sort of sound bites that get credit for. I tell people all the time, there is no one who wants the shooter out of their neighborhood more so than the family who is just trying to raise their kids and earn a living in that neighborhood.
Right.
No one.
Right.
There's nobody on the east side of town that wants it as bad as they do. What that person also doesn't want, though, is their 17-year-old son to get pulled over because he didn't use his directional and have a negative interaction with law enforcement.
Right.
The reality is that we can do both. What are referred to as focused deterrent strategies, group violence intervention strategies, intelligence-led policing strategies, do both. They recognize that a very small percentage of individuals and a very small percentage of what's referred to as street groups or gangs produce the overwhelming majority of violence.
Correct.
And so you flood your resources and your enforcement mechanisms on those individuals and groups rather than policing a neighborhood.
Right.
The reality is that an African-American young man in the California neighborhood of Louisville versus a white young man in St. Matthews who both don't use their directional or both kind of slide through a stop sign, that African-American young man in California is much more likely to get pulled over than that white kid in St. Matthews, not because of the individual biases of the officers, but because Louisville employs a suppression-style policing method, and so law enforcement is just more omnipresent in California than it is in St. Matthews. If we move to those intelligence-led policing strategies, then we would know that that is just a young man that we have no interest in, that he doesn't come up in any of our stuff. He just didn't use his directional, and so let him go.
Right.
You don't need the officers as omnipresent in the neighborhood. And then you have fewer of those negative interactions between law enforcement and the community, and you have far more positive interactions because the community then sees them actually arresting and prosecuting the very people that are making it more difficult to live in that neighborhood than it otherwise would be.
Can we do that without invading people's privacy, though? You talk about intelligence-led. That means a lot of watching.
Well, we definitely can, because the reality is that most of your truly bad actors, especially in the context of street groups, are publicly known. The neighborhood knows who they are.
Right.
Law enforcement knows who they are. Social services organizations know who they are. The schools know who they are. And so you don't have to necessarily invade anybody's privacy to collect most of the information necessary to do that. And then there are all these algorithms and different programs that can then draw connections between people and things like that, that again doesn't require any sort of actual invasion of privacy.
Tried doing that in places like Chicago, haven't they been accused of racism then?
So it depends on how well you do it, quite frankly.
Okay.
The places that have done this well, Boston, Cincinnati, Oakland, do it in a way that gets a significant amount of community buy-in. And the sort of essential step in this process before anybody is hauled in and arrested is what they have these sort of call-ins.
Mm-hmm.
And what they do is they bring everybody in and they say, gangbanger Timmy, gangbanger Jimmy, we know what you're doing. We know what's going on. Here are all these resources that are available to you. You need temporary housing, we can get you temporary housing. You need diapers and baby formula, we can get you diapers and baby formula. Here, whatever you need, we'll help you get.
Right.
But in the event that you don't take us up on this and you continue to do the things that you've been doing, we are going to come down on you and all the people you hang out with in your little gang hard.
Right.
Because you're all on probation or you're all on parole, so we all have those levers we can pull. We know you're violating those things, and so with the additional scrutiny, you're going to end up getting caught because of that. And when that is done well, the response from the community is, well, those guys knew. I mean, they were given this opportunity to
right.
leave this lifestyle behind
right.
and didn't take advantage of it. And so there is very little sympathy when they then don't take advantage of those things and they end up arrested.
So it's more interventional.
Correct. If you do it without that component, which some cities have done in the past, they basically put out like a 40-person most wanted list and said they're going after these people.
Yeah.
That can have some sort of negative consequences to it. But there's been a pretty robust body of research on these focused deterrent strategies. And overwhelmingly what is found is that they improve police community relations, A, because of the sort of procedural justice component that we just talked about, but also because they take out the bad apples and leave everybody else alone.
Fascinating. Why can't we have that conversation nationwide? What's hindering that? The shouting on either
well,
side?
Well, so that's part of it. That's part of it. It's also complicated and nuanced and kind of policy wonkish.
Right.
And so my hope is that even if it's not a part of the dialogue that's on the New York Times opinion page, that it is a part of the dialogue in cities other than Louisville. Because
right.
I can tell you that it's part of the dialogue here in Louisville.
Right.
We're pushing it. Some other people are pushing
Which
it.
Is
but
hopeful.
It's my hope that in other cities that these conversations are also going on.
Yeah, and you have a chance. You have an opportunity, a window of opportunity with Louisville because there's going to be new leadership.
Right.
And that conversation is that whoever comes in is going to want to fix this right away.
Right.
You know? So, all right, we've got about 10 minutes left. I want to talk about the Supreme Court. I know this is
sure.
something that you're fascinated with and you study. I posed a question the other day, is the Supreme Court truly conservative or is it more libertarian? And I know there's this argument about the Supreme Court right now that's going on that is partisan. You know, President Trump is like, look, we need more justice. I can't quite understand what he means. Is he asking for like additional justices, which is what the left is asking for? In other words, stacking the court, which is a terrible idea. Or is he just saying, hey, let's figure out a way to get rid of a couple of justices and replace them?
Right.
I don't know what he's calling
right.
for. Either way, it's inexplicable. I also think that the decisions being made by Justice John Roberts are inexplicable at times. First of all, what do you think of the DACA decision? What's your analysis of that?
So, you know, I think that that is a quintessential Justice Roberts situation. Justice Roberts likes to decide decisions on technicalities. He likes very narrow decisions. He doesn't like things that end up sweeping and wide ranging. And so I think that decision is a demonstration of that. Justice Roberts also likes to write decisions where he is sort of the sole Republican appointee, so that decisions don't end up being more sweeping. I mean, you saw this in the Obamacare decision, which obviously upset a lot of conservatives. But I think Justice Roberts would tell you that what he did with that decision, while ultimately bad for the specific facts of that case, put us on a path that that will end up being good for textualists and originalist interpretations down the line. I don't know that I personally believe that, but that is absolutely Justice Roberts' philosophy of this sort of incrementalism, of being very targeted and sort of surgical in decision making, not being wide ranging, but also sort of inching towards what I think he would prefer in terms of judicial interpretation.
So is the discussion that's being had right now about this decision wrong in the media on both sides? The right side of the media is saying this is unbelievable. It's unthinkable. What Justice Roberts did was allow presidents to bind future presidents to executive orders. On the other side, on the left, they're saying, no, that's not what happened. What happened is that Justice Roberts is saying that the Trump administration didn't follow the rules in overturning it. When I read part of the actual ruling, it looked like they just said, well, the Trump administration has a right to get rid of it, but they did it with a bad attitude. And I'm like, so I'm trying to make heads or tail of what that decision actually means. So yeah, is the media framing this in a partisan way and missing the point, or what is the point?
The answer to that question will always be yes. Is the media framing this in a partisan way and missing the point, regardless of what the subject matter is?
Of course. Why did I even ask?
Yeah, so absolutely to that. But it is more in line with the Supreme Court saying, you can do this, you just didn't do this the right way. And conservatives often overplay their hand on the Colorado wedding cake baking case, because again, that was a decision where the Supreme Court did a very similar thing.
It was very
what
narrow.
It said to Colorado was that you did this improperly. That it's
the attitude that you had.
The possibility,
right?
Correct.
Yeah, that decision was purely. That decision was purely about the attitude of the Colorado Human Rights Commission, as opposed to the merits of the case.
Correct. You targeted this individual. You did it in a particularly egregious way. And so again, whenever Justice Roberts is involved in a decision like that, you're going to see that kind of ruling most of the time. It's the way he likes cases to go. And so I think that's what you're seeing with this.
The problem with that is though that to me it's an abdication of the Supreme Court's responsibility. I don't want a legislative Supreme Court, but at the same time, some of these issues being discussed here drive to the root of key core freedoms, like the Baker case, right? I mean, this is a matter of where your right to your lifestyle clashes up against Joe's right to his belief religiously and to practice his business as he sees fit. This is a fundamental discussion in America where one person's rights end at another person's nose. And so if the court is not going to deal with stuff like that because they don't want to be seen as, I don't know, is Justice Roberts just using that as a way to hide behind he doesn't really want to do anything huge?
Well, so there's this axiom in law that tough cases make bad law.
Okay.
And so basically, anytime you have a bad set of facts, a tough set of facts, and you are end up creating new law as a result of it, that law is almost always going to be bad down the line. Well, the reality is that the overwhelming majority of cases that end up at the Supreme Court are tough or bad cases. And so I think the way that Justice Roberts looks at this is to say, we for too long took tough cases and made bad law. I mean, that was the MO of the Warren Court. The Warren Court took every tough case they could and made bad law with it. And so I think he sees his role in opposite to that, to try to sort of do that. And in my opinion, it's a pendulum swinging too far the other direction.
Right.
But I think that's why you see some of that.
Right. Because I would argue that he did bad law with the healthcare bill, because he created something that was not there when he said, oh, it's a tax, when the Obama administration was arguing it wasn't a tax. So he literally created something out of whole cloth in order to make a narrow decision, which is hypocritical.
Yeah, I'm completely sympathetic to that. It's my position as well. I agree with that. But I just think that that's his thought process in a lot of these cases.
Yeah, even if he has to jump over a couple of hoops to get there. So let's back it out to a bigger, broader discussion then, like the LGBT decision. You know, that didn't really cause a lot of ripples in society because, for one, right now, you know, we live in cancel culture, and anybody who speaks up about anything of any significance in that area will get canceled and shut down. But for the other part of it is, I think most of us just don't really care how people choose to live their lives and who they choose to love anymore. And we obviously don't want people getting fired because they happen to be gay. I didn't really dive into the details of that decision, but I'm looking at the court from a 30,000 foot view. And in some ways it seems as though people might be wrong to try to label this court as a right-wing court or a left-wing court. And it may be more of a libertarian court. What do you say to that?
So I think that the decision in that case is a really good example of something that, if you are super into modes of interpretation, especially on the right, is really eye-opening. For decades in this country, what Ronald Reagan believed in terms of economic liberalization, strong national defense, and sort of traditional family values became what defined American conservatism in politics, because he was the first president to be sort of an unabashed conservative. It defined what conservatism was. And every couple of decades, there'll be somebody new who jumps on the space. Now we obviously have President Trump, who can sort of redefine what political conservatism is, but it's sort of made in the image of its bearer.
Right.
Right of center judicial scholarship in this country, and what most people thought it meant to be sort of a Republican appointed judge, was defined by Antonin Scalia. Mm-hmm. He was the first textualist and originalist to really make it onto the court. You know, he and Robert Bork wrote just pages and pages and pages of what it meant to be a textualist and an originalist. And so for a very long time, to be a right-of-center judge in this country meant that you were a textualist and an originalist. But there's nothing inherent about those two beliefs about constitutional interpretation that binds them together. And I think what you saw in Justice Gorsuch's decision on that case was that Justice Gorsuch is a textualist, but not necessarily as much of an originalist. The operative thing in that case that differentiated the majority opinion from the minority opinions is the definition of the word sex.
Right.
To Justice Gorsuch, sex was to be interpreted under contemporary definitions. And so if you cannot discriminate on the basis of sex, and you discriminate on a man who is married to a man, but not a woman who is married to a man, you are discriminating on the basis of sex. So that's a textualist interpretation.
Right.
What is the plain meaning of the law? But it is not necessarily an originalist opinion as it relates to what was the plain meaning of the word at the time that that statute was passed. Justice Alito, in his dissent, really kind of takes Justice Gorsuch to task on this and says that there is no reason to believe that when Section 7 was passed, that sex meant anything other than biological sex, man and woman, right. not sexual orientation, and certainly not gender identity.
Right.
And that's sort of the discrepancy there. But again, that's a question of matter of interpretation. I think the thing that libertarians ought to have some pause about before they have a sort of victory lap on this court is the same day that decision came out, the court rejected every challenge to qualified immunity that they had and every gun rights challenge that they had, two issues that I think are very important to libertarians in this country.
Right.
And so before sort of celebrating the libertarian tent of the court, just know that they are regularly rejecting cases that I think libertarians would be.
Why is this court so afraid of the Second Amendment?
You know, I think with the fundamental rights cases, courts take big leaps when they acknowledge them and then when they incorporate them against the states. And then they get very careful about how and where they apply them. Justice Scalia was obviously a huge proponent of addressing the Second Amendment at the court level. He's obviously no longer on the court, and so the Second Amendment has sort of lost a champion by his absence on the court. And I don't know that there's a case that has come across their desk that is sort of egregious enough for them to say, okay, we need to step in again. I think their preference as it relates to the Second Amendment, as is the case with most of the fundamental rights and the Bill of Rights, is to say we have put out enough law on this that the lower courts can kind of handle it, and they can sort of go from there. But like all of the enumerated rights in the Bill of Rights and thereafter, there will likely at some point come a case where they say, okay, we have to weigh in on this.
It feels it feels like right now gun owners should probably just be happy that there's a balancing and there's a pressure balancing where the left is maybe afraid to go too far on guns because if they do, then a right-leaning or at least pro-Second Amendment-ish court would then weigh in on it, and that maybe scares them. And vice versa. We're not sure what a guy like Gorsuch would, or a guy like Roberts would do in a case like this. So there's sort of a pressure balancing aspect to it. Is that, do you agree with that?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, look, folks on the right have an argument in the firearm space of unconstitutional that they did not have two decades ago.
Right.
You know, the courts had either routinely punted on Second Amendment questions or had quite frankly ruled in ways that were antithetical to the sense of the Second Amendment.
Yeah.
And so I do think that that's an arrow in the quiver of the gun rights folks that didn't exist 20 years ago. And I do think it shapes some of the national and local conversations about specific statutes that would affect firearms.
Do you think the five conservative-ish judges are sufficiently pro-Second Amendment so as that if it did, an egregious case did come along, they would rule in the right direction?
Probably. I think it would be a bit like the DACA case and a bit like the case of the Colorado Baker in that they would do it in a very narrow way. It wouldn't be sweeping.
I guess we'll find out if Biden
wrote it.
Yeah, I guess we'll find out if Biden gets elected and wants to take everybody's everything but everybody's shotgun away.
Right, exactly.
I mean, if they try to bring back the assault weapons ban, that'll surely raise the court's attention, won't it?
Since it's
been done before and then abolished and then they want to do it again, when at some point isn't the court going to be like, okay, we got to weigh in on this?
I think so. It wouldn't shock me again.
How do you think this court would weigh in on assault weapons, quote unquote assault weapons?
So honestly, it would depend on the details of that assault weapons ban.
Right.
The Second Amendment, like literally every other enumerated right, our case law allows for some regulation of.
Right.
You don't have an unfettered right to free speech. The press doesn't have unfettered rights. The Fourth, Fifth, and Sixth Amendment rights as it relates to criminal proceedings have exceptions in such a way that is remarkably confusing to the practitioners in the space, let alone the average American.
Right.
And so I think it is possible perhaps to craft some sort of federal firearms legislation that passed constitutional muster. But I think it's also entirely possible to pass federal firearms legislation that was a violation of the Second Amendment. We allow for the banning of private ownership, largely of automatic weapons.
Right.
And few people contend that it's a violation of the Second Amendment.
I do.
It's theoretically possible.
I contend that it's a violation of the Second Amendment, but that's me.
Right.
I'm to the right of the NRA on that. I mean, I think if you can, because here's what I would argue about, because everybody always says you don't have an unfettered right to free speech. Yes, you do. You don't have the right to yell fire in a theater because that's not free speech. You're not stating an opinion. You're lying to people to scare them and cause harm. That's basically using the speech that you have as a weapon. That's very different, right? So I have you don't have a right to regulate my firearms. You have a right to regulate what I do with my firearms, okay? And right. I think that's a very important distinction that we should make, because I hear a lot of people use that statement. They're like, "Well, you have no unfettered right to free speech. The press doesn't have unfettered access." Yes, they do. What the press can't do is lie, although they get away with it now.
Right.
What you can't do is lie and say that there's a fire in a theater when there's not, in order to bring harm to someone. Just like I can't point my gun at you and shoot you unless I'm defending myself. But what you can regulate is what I can do with that right. What you can't regulate is the right itself.
Well, so that's true as it relates to the fire example, but it's not necessarily true as it relates to like time, place, and manner restrictions,
right?
Which the court has repeatedly held have to be narrowly tailored to a specific government interest. But
well, the court's wrong, and they need to talk to me next time.
Right. but you can't display, for example, pornography on a billboard.
Correct.
You have a right to free speech in pornography broadly, but we don't allow it to be displayed on a billboard.
Right.
And so that's why I say.
But that doesn't limit possession of something, right? Like it's like you can limit possession of pornography to adult actors that are all in agreement of being a participant. And you can say you cannot possess child porn. Why? Well, because you're victimizing someone, right? There again, you're using that freedom to cause harm to someone. That's what you regulate. You regulate the thing that causes harm as opposed to the item itself. Is where I would come from.
Right. So let's say, for example, the left was right about AR-15s, which statistically they're not, but let's say for the sake of discussion that they are, and that the use of the AR-15, like it is the school shooter's gun, and it doesn't have other, lawful purposes to it. It's theoretically possible for a statute to pass that would ban it, and then the court would say that it's narrowly tailored enough, given that it's a specific firearm and that it's related to a specific government need, which is school shootings. Of course, statistically, none of that is true, and so it's irrelevant. But I only say all that to say that it's theoretically possible for legislatures to craft bills that would pass constitutional muster, but outside of things like prohibitions from felons owning firearms, outside of things like automatic weapons bans, it becomes much more difficult and much more unlikely that it would pass constitutional muster. Because in truth, given what we know about firearms-related homicides and that the overwhelming majority of them are committed by handguns, the government interest is actually more related to handguns than it is to long guns.
Right.
But of course, handguns are much more frequently used for personal defense or sport or protection of a home than any of those things altogether. And so I think the court, because it has weighed in the way it has before, wants to avoid having to deal with some of these questions that are nuanced and sort of legislative in their nature in terms of values of the country and statistics and things like that. But if there were an opportunity or if there were an occasion where a state or a locality did something that was particularly egregious, I do think the court would weigh in on that.
Fascinating. Dude, we need to have more conversations like this. I love this stuff. Diving a little deeper and getting into the nuances of it. It's good stuff. Joshua Crawford, Pegasus Institute, thanks for coming on, man.
Yeah, my pleasure. Always a pleasure.
One of my favorite guests. Always enjoy it. We will chat soon.
Sounds good to me.
All right. Good stuff, man. I love that guy. He is such a great thinker. He's very smart, very intelligent. And I love the back and forth. You will find me to the right of the NRA and everybody else on firearms. And, you know, that brings an interesting discussion, though. You know, and I'm thinking to myself, I'm like, wait a minute, you can regulate what I do with it, but you can't regulate that I have it. Right? Because that's the whole point. Like, you can regulate what you do with speech to a certain extent. You can't lie about somebody. You can't defame somebody. You can't create a riot. You can't infoam violence. You can't threaten violence, right? That's all arguably use of speech, but it's a use of speech as a weapon, right? Well, you can't regulate, in my opinion, what I own as a firearm or a weapon. You can only regulate what I can do with that weapon. You can regulate me to self-defense. And now regulations that involve you have to get a background check. To me, that is part of regulating what I can do with that firearm, right? As long as I haven't committed a crime that shows I have a tendency towards violence, then I am someone who is a law-abiding citizen. Therefore, you can't limit my ability to possess that gun. You can only limit my ability to possess that gun if I've demonstrated a willful violence, right? So again, that falls in line with the principle that I'm talking about here. You know, the same even with the idea of concealed carry, right? To a certain extent, it could be argued. I like to carry my firearm concealed because of two reasons. One, I don't want to let a bad guy know that I've got it. And two, I don't want to make people uncomfortable around me, right? So those types of regulations fall within that idea of what you can do with it, but not necessarily that you can have it. And then, of course, once you start to move into the area of regulating whether I can possess it out in public to protect myself, again, we're stepping on that principle of, no, I have it to protect myself. That's what the inalienable right is for. Anyway, interesting discussion. Maybe we could dive into that a little bit more down the road as well. That's it for me today. Hey, thanks for listening. Continue to share the podcast. It's getting thousands of downloads a week, and I thank you for that. I love you, each and every one of you. Thanks for listening. You can find me on Instagram at GreatlyLondo and at The Disruption Zone, and on Twitter at Leland Show and at Zone Disruption. And we're also on Facebook, so find us there as well. We are free download. Just go to Apple Podcasts, Google Play, or to iHeartRadio app and search The Disruption Zone. It'll deliver new episodes straight to your phone. So you can always have me around in your pocket. Yes! Thanks to Dynamics Productions for their production help with this. Thanks to JP Web Design as well. And to my co-host and co-executive producer, Cameron Mills. I am Leland Conway, The Disruption Zone.